Oh, it's a work session. Oh, that's a public hearing. Thank you. Call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2656. And in case you can't tell, that's not Representative Buckley. It's his alter ego today, right?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Ainsworth. I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley, who wishes he could be here, but unfortunately he is unable to attend. Before you have House Bill 2656. This bill is really simple, except for the fact that the manner in which it's written and presented in front of you is not actually what it does. The summary says it equates mandated health insurance coverage of biological child with mandated health insurance coverage of adopted child. What the bill actually does is provide coverage for congenital birth defects. And so,
I'm sorry, for what?
For congenital birth defects. So when I received the bill back from council, I thought they gave me the wrong one. This obviously didn't go over well when I brought it up with the staff there. But I've been assured in the LC opinion that I presented to the committee that the bill actually does accomplish what we seek to accomplish. Basically arose from a constituent in Representative Buckley's district who has a congenital birth defect that led to him needing dental implants. This could not be done until after age 18 when the jaw was fully formed, and coverage for this procedure was denied on the basis that it was cosmetic and not a medical procedure. And there is an exception in his insurance plan for coverage of these as a medical procedure if you're under the age of 18 to fix a congenital birth defect, as the procedure couldn't take place until he was past that age. It appeared to be a loophole, and eventually the appeals board deemed that the coverage was medically necessary, and so he was able to obtain it, but we want to try and close this loophole. And again, that's what the bill actually does, contrary to what the summary states.
And it was originally, the bill was changed to originally encourage people to adopt special needs kids. I think that's where it came from. To allow them to adopt kids that had special needs, knowing they were going to have problems later in life, and wanting to make sure that it was covered by insurance. That was the original intention.
Of our bill, no.
No, the statute amending.
Okay, yes.
The reason it's in the statute that you're amending,
mm-hmm.
which has this for adopted kids but not for natural kids,
mm-hmm.
was a way to encourage the adoption of kids with special needs. But it did seem to create this odd.
Well, you have a far greater knowledge of all these areas.
Memory.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's all I have to present to you. I'll take any quick questions you may have.
Are there questions? And are there other people? This is a work. This is a public hearing and work session. Has anybody else? I'm going to close it anyway if it has, but I want to know whether we have.
I'll go down and check.
See if anybody signed up for 26.
Okay.
Just 56.
Senator.
Yeah. No.
Well.
Chairman Powell. We would testify when together.
Okay, excellent. We'll bring it back up then.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker is also here. She only has 15 minutes, so Representative Nathan's willing to let to go afterwards.
Good. Okay, excellent. Then, are there any questions of Representative Buckley's alter ego? Thank you. We will open it up again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Fine. Let's close the public hearing on 2345. Nope.
We closed this one.
On 2656, and we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2589. And welcome Senator Walker to the. I want to point out how Representative Nathanson is being very patient and allowing folks with other appointments to come in front of him. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I appreciate Representative Nathanson waiting. I won't take very long. Normally, I'm in the building until about 9 p.m. on Friday nights, but this evening I have to get out of the Capitol at 3:15. So I'm here on House Bill 2589 because Representative Cannon graciously called me in the interim and said, what happened to your bill last session on hearing aids for children, Senate Bill 14? And I said, well, didn't go anywhere, and he said, well, I'd like to reintroduce that. So here we are reintroducing a bill to allow hearing aids for children. You know, I just have to tell you, my husband doesn't get involved very often in politics here at the Capitol other than our motorcycle bill this session that we hope to send your way. Both of us are motorcycle riders, and so we have a bill on training. But he talks to me a lot, but he doesn't very often say, I've got a bill idea for you, because he knows I get that all the time. But here are my notes, which I've kept on hand. This is my husband talking to me in December 12th of 2006, Mr. Chair. We should require insurance companies to cover hearing aids for children. There are over 12,000 kids per year who have a hearing aid deficiency or a hearing deficiency, and I saw it on the nightly news tonight, and insurance companies don't consider it a medical problem. So I said, well, we can fix that. And so, Mr. Chair, I drafted Senate Bill 14 at the request of my husband last session because it was important. And so let me just give you a teeny bit of background, and then Representative Cannon and others can fill you in later. But, you know, early in my career in the legislature, I think it was in 1999 and again in 2001, we implemented newborn infant hearing screening. We expanded that. That is an incredible opportunity to catch these children before they're too old to know if they're having trouble hearing, because infants as young as 4 weeks old can actually be fitted with hearing aids and assistive devices. And the earlier that hearing loss is detected in a child's life, the more serious the effect will be on their development. If you can catch it early, you can really help them be successful. Research certainly shows that children identified with hearing loss who begin services before 6 months of age can speak as well as peers of their own age who do not have a hearing loss. There are various options available to families for children who need hearing aids, but not many. Through their insurance. Insurance companies are not required to provide it in Oregon. It's much like orthodontia care, though I would probably challenge you and say that orthodontia is probably more available insurance plans than hearing aid coverage. My father-in-law needed a hearing aid, and he could never get coverage through Medicare. Some states allow it through Medicare, but not Oregon. At any rate, if you're on Medicaid, you can get a hearing aid. Some schools will allow your child to get a hearing aid through the IDEA funds that are available to states, though, as you know, those are pretty limited, though this Congress has decided to finally at least fund IDEA at a better level than they have in the past.
This isn't a...
It's not the Education
not
Committee.
Not the Education Committee. Could you...
Yeah.
Spell out the...
Oh, Individuals with Disability Education
Thank
Act.
You.
Thank you. I'm sorry. So I've lived with that term for several
yes,
years.
Yes, I'm sure you have.
So, but the point is that hearing aids are very costly, and for children, they must be changed pretty frequently because the mold will need to be replaced. The hearing aid part can last, but hearing aids last about 7 to 8 years. A basic instrument goes for $900, and they can go up to several thousand. So you can see that a family that doesn't qualify for Medicaid is going to have a difficult time getting a hearing aid for their child to be able to hear what we hear every day in our life. So, Mr. Chair, that's why this bill is before you. I'm certain that Representative Cannon and others can talk to you about their experience. I see there are a number of people signed up to testify, and they're probably people with children who've experienced these problems. So that would be my testimony for you today.
Representative, well, should we ask Senator Walker questions and then close the hearing and get back to it in a few minutes? Is that for you?
That would be fine.
Are there questions of Senator Walker?
Save your hard ones for me.
I have just a couple, and you can... Here, both. I mean, we do have mandated. We had something about implants, right?
Cochlear implants.
And
that last session.
And what we passed was, if they cover one, they need to cover two.
Two.
But we didn't mandate covering them. Is that right?
No,
is that
we did. No, we. If they had one implant, if they covered one, they had to
then,
cover.
Then they had to cover two if two were medically necessary.
But
it didn't mandate covering one, was or did it?
I actually believe it did.
Okay. That was one question. And I wonder whether you've turned up
some sense of the incidence of need for this? You'll have some.
I do.
You'll have some testimony on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Cannon. I believe Representative Cannon has done some research, updated research on that.
Great.
I think the need is great. It is pretty significant. And, you know, we want our children to learn as well as other children in the classroom. And those who can't see have a problem when they don't know that they need glasses. And those who can't hear have a problem when they don't know what their problem is. And then when we diagnose it and we can't get a hearing aid for these children, then something's lost here. It was hard enough communicating with my father-in-law when he didn't have a hearing aid, but at least he had the benefit of being an adult when his hearing went bad. And then he got a hearing aid, and most of the time he kept it turned off, which didn't make a lot of sense.
Yes. He didn't want to hear you in the first place.
But it was hard for him to adjust, and the batteries go out. I remember he bought batteries a lot. And then when he passed away, we donated his hearing aid to the Lions Club so that they could find someone else who could use it, because it was a very expensive piece of equipment. I know there's a lot of mandates in insurance policies, but, you know, you just have to take a look at who you're trying to assist here. And this is not a mandate for adults. It's a mandate for children.
And I think we don't mandate eyeglasses for children. Is that right?
I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chair, but I would say
I think
no.
That is not a mandate.
I have to tell you, the first time I got eyeglasses, I was in my 40s, and I'd never had an eye exam in my entire life. And the lobbyist for the eye doctors said he was not happy to hear that. So I finally went in, and I had not noticed any problem, because when you travel in your own community, you don't notice a problem. But when you go door knocking in someone else's district and you can't read the street signs, then you know you're in trouble. So I went, and when I got my glasses, I came outside, and there were these two little children out there. They looked like twin girls, and they had pretty big glasses on, and I looked outside and I said, oh my gosh, I can see. And these girls looked at me like I was a dummy. But, you know, who's this adult saying she can see? But it was the first time in years I realized that I had not been able to see the intricacies of leaves and color. And it was absolutely amazing.
That's what I noticed the first time. All of a sudden there was color in the world.
Right. And so that's the same thing with a child who can hear. When you put a hearing aid or a cochlear implant, and I have a very good friend whose daughter just got her second cochlear implant. You know, it's amazing. The world now is a new place for them. So this is what we're trying to do for children, and I really appreciate Representative Cannon sticking with it and coming back this session with it. And we hope you can do better than I did.
Senator Walker, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you again for taking me out of order.
You have a comment?
Yes. One other comment about cochlear implants. It's any health insurance plan that covers a cochlear implant must provide for bilateral implants,
right?
So they don't have to cover them.
Right. That's what I thought, and I think eyeglasses are also not covered either. I will.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Drive carefully.
Thanks.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2589, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2755. Representative Nath, thank you so much for being patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. That's North Eugene. I believe that you have received a hand-engrossed copy of the bill with amendments that I have prepared in conjunction with, as a result of discussions with Department of Consumer and Business Services. I believe you may also already have a copy of a letter from the Oregon Health Fund Board. One of the top concerns of constituents is the cost of health care and health insurance. Just as important it is to increase access to health care, it's critical to address the cost to slow the skyrocketing increases in health care and health insurance. Health care costs too much, and the costs are escalating far beyond the rate of inflation and people's ability to pay. More and more residents are uninsured or underinsured. And as more people lose insurance, the public sector will inevitably bear more of the costs of health care. Of the 500,000 Oregonians who lack health insurance, most are either employed or dependent on someone who is employed. A disproportionate number of those lacking insurance are employed by small businesses that are unable or unwilling to pay the high premiums required for health plan coverage. In addition to the currently uninsured, another 299,000 insured Oregonians have experienced a health insurance coverage gap at some time during the previous 12 months. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is the primary regulator of the commercial health insurance market, where roughly 42% of Oregonians get their insurance. From information supplied by the department covering the first three quarters of 2008, so this is pretty recent information, rates for individual health care plans increased an average of 17.7%, and rates for small group health plans increased an average of 11%. Inflation has been averaging less than 3%, while medical cost inflation has been more like 9% per year. So it makes you wonder, when you see health insurance rate increase requests for 15%, 20%, 25% or more, on top of last year's rate hikes, we need to understand what factors are driving the escalation in insurance rates and see what we can do to slow it down. That's why I've introduced House Bill 2755 concerning reinsurance. Reinsurance is essentially insurance for insurers. It allows primary insurers to spread or share the risk with secondary insurers or reinsurers. Many primary insurers currently purchase private reinsurance in order to protect against the risk that policyholders' medical expenses will unexpectedly exceed what they estimated. Public reinsurance pooling has currently been adopted or is under review for use in the regulation of private insurance in other states, including New York, Arizona, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. In the ongoing discussions of health care reform in Oregon, the concept of a single state-negotiated reinsurance plan has been identified as a possible way of spreading risk in the individual and small group markets to enable insurance carriers to compete based on quality and efficiency rather than on the health status of their customers. Some type of risk spreading or reinsurance mechanism would almost certainly be necessary if we move to a health insurance exchange or other form of guaranteed issue market in which buyers of insurance cannot be refused coverage due to pre-existing conditions and poor health. How to structure risk spreading or reinsurance as a concept will require analysis, the type of analysis proposed by this bill. This bill is not the action, it is the analysis and the study of the idea. I hope you'll agree that we should put the wheels in motion to start this work now. We, Oregon citizens and Oregon's businesses, really can't afford to wait any longer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I found the amendment. I didn't find the Hannah Gross one, though. I think it is. But I did it myself.
Okay.
Are there any questions? Representative, we do not have a fiscal statement on this yet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Well, maybe this is not the appropriate time.
Isn't this essentially in 2009?
I mean, not the detailed language that's here, but the fact that they need to study reinsurance?
That I think is one of the issues that needs to be studied by the authority board in getting ready to do an exchange, yes.
Right. And so why would we not roll this into 2009 if it's already one of their, not mandates, but one of their charges? And, I mean, because I think it's a very interesting question. I'm not convinced that reinsurance is the answer because someone's still paying the bill somewhere. But I think it's a very interesting question.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to comment on Representative Maurer's. I agree that it should be, the question of reinsurance should absolutely be a part of 2009, but I don't think that necessarily, I mean, I think we have a few bills that fall in the category that might be good things to do on their own and or rolled up into 2009. 2009 is very big, and it, I shouldn't say it's fate's uncertain, but it's there's so many pieces of this. This, I think, works as a standalone as well as part of 2009. I would advocate you do both. Or not necessarily not do this or other similar bills just because we think it's going to be in 2009. I don't think redundancy hurts us here.
Others? Representative Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have anybody else signed up to testify on... Dr. Smith, I think you do. Mr. King? Oh, we got the big guns. We got DCBS coming for us. We got Office of Health Policy Research coming after us. We got...
And then you have
OMIP. I didn't know which hat you were wearing today.
You want me to start, right?
Sure. Go for it,
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research. And House Bill 2755 furthers the work and recommendations of the Oregon Health Fund Board, which my office staffs and can provide the state more options to consider to expand access to care for Oregonians. As part of my testimony is the letter that Representative Nathanson mentioned from the Health Fund Board. It's in the back, paper clip to mine. Many health plans purchase private reinsurance to protect themselves from unexpectedly large numbers of high-cost insurance claims and for other business reasons. A purchaser of health coverage, particularly for groups or individuals who would be newly insured, oftentimes pay for the insurer's fear of risk. That's sort of my own terms of trying to understand this concept, or potentially expensive costs greater than expected. By sharing in the payment of some portion of the claims through a reinsurance mechanism, some states have looked to this as a means of bringing down the cost of buying coverage. New York State has been doing this since 2001 in a program called Healthy New York, initially started with some tobacco settlement dollars, and it's a state-funded reinsurance program that now covers almost 150,000 people, including many small groups who are now able to purchase insurance that has significantly lower price premiums than if they were buying it outside of the program. And New York actually buys more of the middle corridor as per the traditional reinsurance is often at the higher end of costs. And I attached a diagram at the end of my testimony summarizing their approach. Because of New York's efforts, reinsurance has been actively discussed at many national meetings I've attended with other states. Staff from the Office of Private Health Partnerships and I participated in a reinsurance institute about a year and a half ago, sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, to try to better understand what New York had done, what were their pitfalls, and maybe to help other states to be able to do this without having to learn on their own. And the foundation funded some modeling and analytical support and picked three states to do that, Wisconsin, Rhode Island, and Washington State, to better understand the unique features of different state markets and estimate the impact of reinsurance. The summary document from that modeling of those three states shows that reinsurance from state support did expand coverage among the previously uninsured. Premium reductions were about a third overall, although that varied by the assumptions made in the model and the state's unique characteristics. Most of the impact occurred because of increased employer offers of coverage. And it solidified existing coverage by making it less likely that small employers would drop coverage and allowing some people with individual coverage to switch to group coverage. Again, this is a modeling exercise, but while Healthy New York focused on the previously uninsured, some of this modeling suggests that this mechanism could be a way to sustain employers' efforts to continue to offer insurance or start offering insurance to their employees. And efforts to recommend strategies to make healthcare coverage affordable for both healthy and high-risk Oregonians and aim to keep insurance rates stable over time. The Oregon Health Fund Board worked through its insurance exchange work group and the finance committee to develop recommendations for market changes, and reinsurance was one of the things they felt needed to be looked at as they develop a more of a business plan for a health exchange. And so the board is in full support of this, and that letter attests to that was given to you today, as a solution to lower costs for small businesses and individuals seeking to obtain or maintain coverage. Expanding access to healthcare services to achieve the board's aim for affordable quality health for all Oregonians. This is one key potential approach, and this study is a great step towards a healthy Oregon.
Thank you.
keep going, then we'll get questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm the acting administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I know we have a lot of people who are here to testify on a lot of bills, so I'll keep my comments very brief. And I think Representative Nathanson, I would just echo her comments. We're looking forward to studying reinsurance, to look at whether the individual and small employer group markets would benefit from reinsurance alternatives, and to look at what other states have done. So we look forward to doing this study and reporting back, and I think this is a great complement to the work that the Oregon Health Authority will be doing. So thank you.
Did you all have a fiscal on this? Did anybody hear about that?
On 27th.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, commonly referred to as OMIP, which provides coverage to Oregonians that are turned down for coverage in the individual market because of pre-existing health conditions. And to some degree, OMIP is a 1980-1990 model of reinsurance, but we're in the year 2011 now. And while it's, or 2009, while it, we will be in 11 in a couple of years, okay. While OMIP's risk-spreading mechanism has been very successful in providing coverage currently for over 15,000 individuals, as you expand and look at small groups and getting everybody under the tent, a more sophisticated and I think more far-reaching reinsurance mechanism is going to have to be developed and will have something to do with the success of our ability to provide coverage to everyone. So we really support moving forward and looking at the different models that perhaps can be brought back to you as a part of the overall plan down the road.
And you're thinking this might be a replacement for OMIP?
Mr. Chair, if 2009 passes through, and a lot of the health fund board report recommendations in terms of individual mandate and public subsidies and getting everybody basically under the tent on a guaranteed issue basis, then there would not be a need for OMIP. So I see OMIP at some point phasing out over the next 2 to 4 years if, in fact, we're able to move forward with the recommendations from the Oregon Health Fund Board.
Okay, questions? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, you asked the question I was going to ask, because this, I see this in essentially as a step toward eliminating the high-risk pool, because the reinsurance pool gives you a mechanism to address high-risk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, that would be correct. For example, right now there's about 200,000 people in the individual market. We get about 15,000 of those because they're high risk, but we spread that risk to 1.6 million, or about 1.7 million people that are insured in the commercial market. If now you expand that market to 3, 4, 500,000, you expand the small business market, we've got to find a way to make sure and spread that risk so it doesn't just focus down on 400,000 or 200,000 people. Otherwise, the cost would be so high in the individual market.
And I think it's important to understand that a reinsurance program inherently does not reduce the cost of health care. What it does is start to address risk and spreading risk, and I think structured appropriately, it can help reduce costs maybe, but it also can do the other. It can give insurance companies incentives to do bad things. And so I think it needs to be studied. It needs to be careful
in
multiple models and have multiple models. At the end of the day, have maybe multiple models available for purchase by insurance companies. But this is really interesting.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Can I ask Bruce Mulligan, please, and Melissa Unger.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and committee members. My name is Bruce Mulligan. I am president and owner of Design for Results Consulting, a human resource consulting firm in Eugene, and I work with large self-funded employers seeking to maintain their health plans through such innovative approaches as operating their own medical clinics and pharmacies. My prior experience includes work with two different physician-owned Oregon health plan contractors, the Lane Individual Practice Association and the Douglas County Individual Practice Association, as well as a risk-assuming health insurer. I mean, I've sat in every chair in this game we call healthcare. I founded a Eugene-based claims administration service for self-funded employers in 2000 and served for a period of time as executive with Safe Corporation and as director of strategic planning for that company. I'm here today in support of the recommendations contained in Senate Bill 2755, particularly as they pertain to establishing a single state reinsurance umbrella to serve as the financial backbone for plans operating under the aggregated market exchange called for in the Health Fund Board recommendations. The study called for in the bill, I believe, will underscore the advantages of such a mechanism to, one, mitigate adverse selection and spread the risk across all plans, two, to reduce costs to purchasers, three, to use established mechanisms to promote consistency in plan claims practices and reporting, and four, forcing insurers to compete on the basis of quality and service based on a standardized risk corridor rather than focusing on health status of enrollees. Reinsurance is not a radical concept. It's a tried-and-true mechanism to adjust risk across accountable health plans and minimize the gaming among plans by pooling reinsurance premiums for all plans participating in the exchange. As financial markets tighten, the cost of reinsurance is likely to increase. It is far more efficient to pool a large population under one reinsurance umbrella rather than making such arrangements for each plan separately. All plans would be covered by the same reinsurance umbrella and subject to the common claims requirements of that umbrella. Carriers offering standard plans under the exchange would pay claims along a narrower risk corridor from first dollar of coverage to the stop-loss limit per claim or aggregate. Rates charged to individuals and groups for these plans would include the cost of reinsurance. This would build on such models routinely used by businesses in Oregon choosing to self-fund their health plans under federal law. Oregon employers to contend with rising health plan costs have long realized that commercial carriers, like any supplier, don't necessarily share the same interests as plan administrators with them as plan owners. While commercial carriers serve a role, it must be first and foremost to serve their organizational and fiduciary interests set by their board of directors. A public reinsurance pool, in contrast, would serve to balance those with health plan or public purchaser interests being at the forefront. Again, the advantages, I think, of this approach would be to use established insurance vehicles to manage adverse selection. It would ensure uniformity and conformity of all insurance plans that are doing business in your exchange. It would require ongoing claims reporting and oversight as a business practice versus some regulation that the state regulator would have to impose on participating plans. Savings or gains from reinsurance would be retained to pay benefits and lower costs. One of the realities that you may not realize is that reinsurance is seen by a risk-assuming health carrier as a revenue stream. I underscore that. It is a revenue stream. The locus of control is retained by the publicly accountable health plan. The health authority would retain control over what was going on with the overall claims costs and with their overall experience. It would greatly simplify rate codes for carriers, limiting their costs to the stop-loss limits. So it ought to be a much more streamlined and simpler way to assess what the cost would be for the standard plans that were offered. This would build on the strength of reinsurance carriers' national contracts as well for catastrophic case management. Many of these reinsurance carriers have very specialized contracts to deal with, catastrophic brain trauma cases and those sort of things that are negotiated on a national basis. Your better reinsurance rates, the bigger the pool, the better the rate you get. And finally, it would provide an easier transition for some public pools that you might wish to also include in this reinsurance umbrella. Rocky King mentioned OMIP. You could also look at PEB. It's a fact of life that many of the Oregon Health Plan contractors have difficulty sometimes getting secure reinsurance limits and may not see the kind of attractive rates that a larger pool could gain for them. I guess I'd like to conclude by saying don't let anybody scare you into believing these recommendations are in any way radical. They are, in fact, what self-funded employers routinely do to stay in business and stay in the healthcare game. They can go a long way to creating a publicly accountable financial backbone that would serve to unify a diversity of plans under a common reinsurance umbrella owned by the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm representing the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. And I'm not the expert on health care in our organization, but Felisa Higgins couldn't be here today, so I'm testifying in her stead. So we are here testifying in support of of Household 2755, for all the reasons that have pretty much been said before I got up here. But I do want to address that we think that this will help achieve the goal of accessible and affordable health care for all. And that the DCBS and or the new health authority should look into options regarding public plans that will compete in the private insurance market. And at a time when unemployment continues to rise in our state and part-time unemployment increases, I think the individual health care market may be the only place where people will be able to purchase health care, and that makes this plan and looking at reinsurance even more important at this time. And so we support this bill. We hope that it passes through, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yep. Mr. Mulligan, a question about an Oregon reinsurance pool.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, it seems to me there may not be value having Oregon being in the same pool as, say, state of New York or Florida, because their standards of practice are so much different.
Sure.
Costs are different. Could Oregon stand alone?
With the number of lives you're talking about, certainly it could.
For true reinsurance.
For true reinsurance, it certainly could. In fact, I believe, go back in distant past history, during the election that John Kerry was running for president, his health plan proposal that was put forward in that election was to have regional reinsurance pools, but they were regional in nature. I would envision they might be like Northwest. If it was big enough, it could be. Oregon certainly is big enough. Right now, what's happening is every single plan is going out and securing its own coverage, often with the same companies. I mean, we're talking about a handful of carriers who offer reinsurance in a different marketplace, and these market aggregators basically price based on size. So I would say Oregon would definitely be big enough.
And last breakpoints for pool sizes. I mean, at what point do you no longer gain advantage?
I would defer to an actuary to ask. I mean, that's why you're doing the study. It sounds like New York has got some excellent models from the testimony earlier given. Those are significant numbers if they can have indeed realized those premium reductions. So I don't know where the breakpoint is in terms of largeness of size. I can tell you I have employers of 500 to 1,000 employees who are successfully able to secure reinsurance coverage as a self-funded employer in the private market.
Why is there any breakpoint? I mean, it's all about risk aversion. It's not about finances, right? I mean, it doesn't change the cost of health care.
Well,
depending on how you structure the financial arrangement, it changes who retains any upside benefit.
Where the risk is. Yeah, where the benefit and risk is. But basically, this is insuring events that happen. In fact, to a certain extent, reinsurance increases the risk, because once you get to that reinsurance point on an individual case or on a pool, then it's free from then on. But I mean,
it's free for somebody, maybe not everyone.
That's the point. But the point is, I don't understand the notion of a break point. It's true when you have a small group, you have to take into account more uncertainty, and therefore the premium for reinsurance is higher than for a large group. But if a pool wants to be risk averse, it could be 2 million members. Why not?
No, my point is 3.6 million people enough, large enough to establish its own company, or is it maybe you need 50 million? That's why these companies don't operate solely in Oregon; they operate across state lines, I would assume.
But if you have your own company, you're self-insuring the risk. You're not reinsuring anymore, right?
At some point, the company's only got, you know, so much money sitting in the bank someplace. And if they have a bad experience here.
Those are financial threshold questions that you'd ask your actuary on how much risk you wish to retain and how much you wish to cede off to a reinsurance carrier.
Okay, well, let's close this hearing. We're not going to... Oh, wait a minute. Before we do that, I think we ought to go into a work session and adopt the amendments, and then we'll be able to get a fiscal for that. So I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on 2755 and ask for an amendment for a motion on the -1 amendments.
And dash two.
Oh, I didn't find twos. Where are twos? I see the ones.
I don't have the twos.
Dash two is at the bottom of the first page line. At addition of 29 and 30.
Yeah,
but
Yeah.
Here's the
two,
the
one
that...
Right?
Yeah. Can I see the
rubber?
Yeah. I was meaning to ditch.
No.
Okay, let's hear both the dash ones and the dash twos.
Mr. Chair,
and that will allow us to get a fiscal.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt dash 1 and dash 2 amendments dated 4-3 and 4-9-09, respectively, to House Bill 2755.
Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection to the amendments? Dash 1 and dash 2 amendments are adopted into House Bill 2755. We'll close the work session on that and await a fiscal. Close the work session on House Bill 2755. Thank you for bringing it to us, Representative. I am going to announce that we're carrying over House Bill 2345 and rescheduling it for hearing on the 22nd of April. I've asked Representative Maurer, who's been leading the work on this bill for a bit, for a report, update.
This isn't just for the committee, it's for the public at large. We have now received two letters, one from the Oregon Nurse Association and the other from the Oregon Medical Association with recommended changes. The Oregon Medical Association changes are being incorporated as much as possible, and the Oregon Nurses Association changes will also be incorporated, I think, successfully without too much objection. And so we still, the fiscal will be very interesting, I think, and not to say that there is consensus ultimately on this bill, but I think there is certainly a train that is moving down the tracks.
And fewer objections, but still some significant ones. Good. So I didn't open anything on that, and it's rescheduled for the 22nd. I would like to open up a work session on House Bill 2535. Therefore, I am opening up a work session. Since I get to do what I like here, almost. And, Madam Administrator, will you tell us about this, please? 2535, down at the bottom.
Yes. There has been a public hearing on this bill. This is a work session. There's a dash 2 amendment, which is basically a gut and stuff, and you have a hand-engrossed version of that in your packet, as well as the dash 2 amendment itself.
As well as a fiscal with the dash 2.
As well as a fiscal. And rather than speak to what the bill does, I'm going to speak to what the amendment does. Basically, it deletes the original bill and creates the charitable prescription drug program within the State Board of Pharmacy. This is the bill that creates donations of prescription drugs. Representative Thompson has been is well aware of this bill and can speak to it also. For the purpose of distributing prescription drugs to needy individuals, the participation is voluntary, and the program may accept prescription drugs in original sealed packaging that displays the lot number and expiration date of the drug. Drugs can't be accepted if the expiration date is less than 9 months from the donation date. And there's other conditions. Can't be misbranding, can't be tampering, evidence of tampering, that kind of thing. Pharmacists will use his or her professional judgment based on a visual inspection to verify compliance and properly dispose of all drugs that do not comply. Program will maintain separate confidential files for individuals receiving the drugs. All personal information must be removed from the labels of the donated drugs. Donated drugs must be kept in a secure location used exclusively for that program. And the recipient of a drug, the donated drugs, must sign a form attesting that the drugs were given to them as part of the donated program, that the pharmacist did a visual inspection,
and that all the participants in the program are immune from liability. And that's essentially what it does.
And roughly, how did the amendment change? Did the amendment change anything?
Well, originally, it changes the name. Originally, it was going to just be called the Prescription Drug Repository Program. It's much more detailed. It gives a lot of detail.
I don't have a hand engrossed either. Yeah.
But the amendment does the whole thing.
I don't have
the amendment either. So.
Yeah, I don't have either.
You guys have amendments?
I have the dash two.
You have the dash two amendments?
I do.
I have the dash two amendments. Well, they might be here somewhere. Huh?
Let me see.
Mr. Chair, I also either misfiled them or didn't receive them in the first place.
Well,
but again, the dash twos are complete.
Right. The dash twos are.
So if somebody has a copy of the dash twos that I can look at.
Here's the dash twos.
Thank you.
You check.
Okay.
I'm trying.
Going.
2435.
Anyway, basically, the difference between the dash two amendment and the original bill is there's a lot more detail in terms of how the program will work, details in terms of what drugs can be accepted, that kind of thing.
And you have the fiscal for the dash twos as well?
Yes.
And I do have the amendment. And I do have a letter as well for the record from Bill Cross, Governmental Affairs Advocate, saying because of Good Friday he's unable to attend, but he wants to let us know that both the Oregon State Pharmaceutical Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists support the amendment and therefore the bill. And he participated in a formal work group by Representative Thompson. And Representative Thompson, could you tell us about this, please?
Well, I remember this came to us from Representative Gelser as a patient request constituent bill. And the issue at hand is, particularly in the case of patients who are issued very, very expensive drugs, then either don't complete the regimen or something happens and they're surplus. And it's not unusual to have $1,500, $3,000 worth of drugs in a single prescription thrown away. There's nothing you can do with them. Other states have put together these charitable pharmacy situations where if the material is proper, can be, your documents have been properly stored and cared for, it can be donated back into the system to use by patients who can't afford those expensive drugs in the first place. So it has a compassionate wing to the foundation of it. The original bill had medical devices and a number of other things in there that were problematic for this kind of bill, and there are probably other ways to deal with those outside the prescription drug arena. And so that part was taken out. And in working with the Board of Pharmacy and others, we put in more protections and more definition of how the program will work. Still to be done is the Board of Pharmacy needs to establish the rules for this. In dealing with them, I'm confident that will happen. They're very supportive of the bill. And I guess to some extent the devil may be in the details, but the outline of the bill is good. It does what it's supposed to do. And I think we ought to move it forward and see. It's not going to be a huge thing. I envision maybe six or seven pharmacies around Oregon may elect to participate in something like this. It's hoped that they would be regional instead of all in Representative Kotek's district or something. But, you know, that's something we have to massage later. I mean, we all know Portland gets all the benefits in Oregon, but it's...
I think Representative Gelson wants to make sure they're all in Corvallis.
Yeah, that's right. But so we really need to move on this now.
Okay.
And you know, put it into action, work with the rules part, and get it moving and see if, obviously if we have problems, the Board of Pharmacy has dealt with problems with prescription drugs. In other contexts, I'm confident they can deal with this one. So it's, I don't know anything more we can do on it to make it better, stronger, or different than what's already been done and protect the original intent.
Representative Bruin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3 of the dash 2 on lines 12 and 13, participants in the program are immune from liability as provided, and participants are defined as either the pharmacy's dispensing or the patient's receiving. And my question has to do with product liability and how that's treated generally. And I can see a situation where, for example, you know that I use insulin. I could have it in the container, unused, unopened, leave it in my car for 4 or 5 days in the heat. It would be completely inert at that point. There'd be no way to tell that if that were given to a pharmacy. The person could use the insulin and have no effect. Whether that be construed as a product liability, I don't know. But the question is there overriding statute on how product liability would be treated in this?
Yeah, there is an element of control in here, and it'll be further worked out in rules. But the idea is to make these things work. The drugs have to be properly stored, and there has to be some kind of a documentation of that. Now, a lot of times, the people that have these particular drugs are under hospice care or detailed care where they've really been under the control of a nurse the whole time. So it's very, very simple. I really doubt that there would be a donation of something like insulin coming in that you would have had opportunity to put in the trunk of your car. It doesn't fit the mold very well. But the idea of the liability limit is that the pharmacist is instructed to do everything in their power to assure the quality of these, but the patient has to acknowledge that they realize these were pre-owned drugs. And can nothing ever happen? We don't have that kind of a surety.
If I may, Mr. Chair, ask the
question.
You
know you may.
Yeah, thank you. Ask the question a little differently than, okay, that would be my fault.
Right,
as
yeah.
In that situation. Yeah. What if the given pharmaceutical, everything's been treated fine, for some reason it's a bad pharmaceutical. My question is, and if I've paid for it or it's been prescribed to me and it kills me or it hurts me, there's product liability there that I could pursue legally. If I give you the drug and there's a faulty product, do you also have product liability rights or not? And that's what I don't understand. That's probably
your question is, if I understand it, but he charges to answer the question.
He finally got smart.
The question is, let's say there's a drug X, and drug X, however it's distributed, has been shown to have a liability problem that somebody's going to be suing the manufacturer of drug X. And now there are somewhere in the chain, some of drug X goes through the regular pharmacy chain, some goes through some other chain, and some goes through this chain. The question is, is there any additional liability in this chain for the distribution of the drug?
Part of that's already covered in pharmacy rule over how we deal with drugs in the first place. And remember, these are not drugs that were just released onto the market as a brand new product. Usually by the time it gets donated back into the system, that drug is going to have been sold in numerous contexts. So let's say there was a manufacturing error and it gets recalled. Well, it would have already been recalled. The pharmacist would know that when they take the drug back in, and because pharmacists have to check lot numbers on all that kind of stuff anyway. So that would be part of the overall quality assurance standard for accepting the drug back. And what was the other part of the question?
Well, it was a broader question than that. You want
to
try it?
I think a general answer to the question, Mr. Chair, is that product liability is not dependent on a person being a direct purchaser. So
I can give you a product, and you own the product.
If something is used for in the manner and purpose for which it was intended to be used, it's not particularly relevant who it is doing the using.
That's the answer. Okay.
So I don't think this would have any particular effect on product liability.
Who got it free.
That's my off-the-cuff answer.
Yeah. I think it's
true. That's why
doctors' offices give drugs to patients all the time.
Yeah, right.
In the samples.
Maybe I'm not hearing this conversation or understanding this conversation correctly, but there's a different twist on it, I think, which may be, does this provision that Representative Bruin mentioned create a kind of immunity that's not currently in place? It says on page 3, lines, I've lost it, 12 and 13, participants are in the program are immune from liability as provided in Section 7. Then you look at Section 7, participants include drug manufacturers, and I'm going to focus on that one because it seems germane to the example of a product that may have gone out improperly onto the marketplace, and if that drug manufacturer is liable for that mistake in the regular marketplace, is it appropriate for them to be immune from liability under this program?
Or would this immunize them for everything else they had done on that drug?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good point. And a more precise way to say what I think we're trying to say here is that you would be immune from liability by reason of participating in the program, not that anybody who participates is therefore liable for immune from everything.
No increased liability from participating in this program.
Right, right.
That was the intent of what we were trying to draft, but we could tighten that up.
I think that might need an amendment then. We were hoping to move it out, but yeah, I either that or take the manufacturer out of the chain in this one is the other way to do it.
No, that wouldn't. That might not.
We could either do it. I was wondering if we could do it in Section 7 rather than in Section...
I don't think that would solve the problem, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Other people and groups mentioned in Section 7, you could make the same argument that they've been immunized beyond what we would want to do.
So we would need a slight change in at line 12 and 13 on page 3 of the amendments?
I would suggest so.
That sound like that would be the
thing? Yeah, were you asking me a question? I would think an amendment, some clarifying language added to lines 12 and 13
on page 3. Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that, because I think the concern may be even, my concern may be a little deeper in that one can imagine a bad actor, a drug manufacturer that is, that dumps bad product into this program and not into the regular marketplace. And the unthinkable, granted, but if, let's say, questionable product, I won't say bad product, questionable product, it is not our intent, I think, to immunize that drug manufacturer for liability associated with...
Then we'll add in good faith.
Putting product into this program that they are not selling elsewhere.
Could we then ask Representative Garrett to work with LC and get an amendment? Would that be acceptable to you? Get an amendment that would solve this problem. Let's adopt the dash twos. And no, let's not. Let's get a dash three that would include the dash twos. And see if we can get it back. And I'm sure that and ask Madam Administrator, would you please ask legislative fiscal for tell them what we're doing.
And as soon as I get the amendment, I'll
ask you. Representative Kinnamer.
On a little different topic. On the first page, Section 3, in line 16, it says the program may accept and distribute, and then it's A is prescription drugs received in original, sealed, tamper-evident packaging. I wondered what that is. I mean, I'm thinking back to when my mother passed away. We had a bunch of her prescriptions.
This didn't seem to be that it's clear.
What is it?
A lot of these products coming in are envisioned to be either professional samples that are sealed individually that you would see in a doctor's office, or blister-packed products that have either been blister-packed for that patient in a daily dose or some other, you know, for some other reason. Bottles of pills that have their seal intact. That's the only way you can guarantee that it goes back to the Tylenol thing. If you can't prove lack of tampering, you can't vouch for the quality of the material. If it's half a bottle of pills that have been used up, God knows what they've been exposed to, and that's an additional liability.
But Jim, let me ask you an example from my experience. When I was receiving 4 bottles of 1cc in 1cc, maybe 10cc injectables, and they were each individually labeled and sealed, but the original container was the box that contained all 4. You think 2 of those at $300 each would be acceptable in this
It would
program?
Be my understanding, I think Paige Clark is here from the board, but that those, if they were individually tamper-proof sealed, would be acceptable.
And labeled individually.
Right. Or part of a 30-day right. blister pack where you got 15 blisters unopened, that 15 could be acceptable even though part of the pack had been used. But not an open bottle of pills where, you know, it's 100 in there and you got 33 left. We don't know what, we have no way of knowing how those were handled.
Representative Kennemer,
that's just what I need.
The answer is mine, too. Okay. Yeah. And we will close the work session on House Bill
2.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, just a very quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thompson, thank you for your work on this. The Board of Pharmacy is supportive or neutral or, you know,
hey, do you want to join us here?
They were very supportive in working on this and putting a lot of detail into it. So,
thank you.
I would. Yeah, they may not want to take a public
stand.
There
were no stand, association but, groups, but I just want to.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotick and committee. Yes, the Board of Pharmacy.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Paige Clark, pharmacist consultant with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. And the board is very supportive of this and worked very hard with Representative Thompson's work group in order to put together a workable plan and put together something that would ultimately be very protective of public safety, first and foremost. So I very much appreciate the comments and the questions that have come forth about the products themselves. And much of that will happen in the rule writing process. Certainly, we crafted a good deal of this with a lot of very specific parameters surrounding the program. We studied other states who have similar types of programs. We pulled some of their language. We looked at things that worked. We looked at what how we have things structured in the state of Oregon. In the state of Oregon, we allow under certain circumstances, for example, in long-term care settings, bubble packing, as Representative Thompson was speaking about, that can be returned under circumstances where it is storage is very carefully monitored. We can track where the medication has been, etc. Similar types of situations will be applied in this case as well to ensure the safety issues that you all have asked about. Definitely.
Great, thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You for working on this. Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. I do. Paige, I do have a question. In the bill, it says that they can't charge for the medication, but the pharmacist, by rule, mm-hmm. could charge for the handling of that, mm-hmm. which leads me to why would only 7, I mean, as a very small number, it seems to me that number may actually be more substantial, given the fact that they could at least recover some of the cost for handling.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, those states that have similar type of programs do allow for a fee for processing for those pharmacists to do this. But generally this is done, and part of the reason that we really chose the term charitable pharmacy is because it really is not intended to be a profitable sort of endeavor at all, but very much a patient-friendly, consumer-friendly aspect. And I think Representative Thompson indicated that in, I think, the state of Georgia, they have maybe 6 of these. They're not large. They're not lots of them. That isn't what we had found out there, but certainly it's a very useful aspect.
Mr. Chair, I don't know, Paige, if you can answer this or not. Is there a personal charitable benefit to doing this? For once, somebody out of their copay at a drugstore when they purchase these drugs, I mean, call it $100, just to easy math, and then submit that to the program, is that a $100 charitable gift?
Sure it is. Okay. Yeah, I would assume it is. I think you need documentation, that kind of stuff. It's into a charitable thing. But
sounds like you need your tax advisor on
neither she or I are a tax. Neither she or I are tax attorneys. But
as a mere pharmacist, I would say that probably, you know, you would definitely want advice on it. That's not something that we had contemplated in the work group.
Show me your 501c3 status.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great.
We'll close the public hearing, and much to Representative Gelser's disappointment, we'll hold this for another amendment as soon as possible.
My understanding that Representative Garrett will take it from here?
Well, he'll take that piece, and then we'll get it
back.
So
that's great. I just wanted to make sure on the record I understood.
It was definitely Representative Garrett.
Yeah.
How is our scheduling looking? Well, all right. I'm also incidentally going to hold over 3041, waiting for. I have requested the speaker's permission to. For us to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on that, we'll wait till we hear from the speaker. So we will not open a work session on 3041. Let's roll it over. That's a good idea. Let's roll it over to Monday, and we'll see if we can get that. I think we'll get an answer one way or the other by Monday. And we could work 2435?
I believe so.
Okay, let's open a work session on 2435.
Okay.
You want to give us a report?
Do you want an introduction first? Or do you just
what are we doing?
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members.
We have a new committee administrator, so we have to be cautious today.
She's a newbie.
I bet she looks like she's up to it. And let's, with any luck, we can move this one through. House Bill 2435 deals with the issue of expediting licenses and issuing temporary licenses by the Oregon Medical Board. It specifies that the director of OMB shall issue limited license to physicians within 14 days after receiving the application. It outlines the physician criteria to qualify for limited licenses and specifies that the limited license is issued for a period of 90 days, renewable if the board has not taken final action on the physician's application for an unlimited license. We have had a couple of meetings about this. We've had a work group session and a subsequent conversation here in which Representative Bruin caught a problem in one of the amendments referring inappropriately to a particular section that was to sunset. And so we are back here now.
Representative Bruin that did that?
No.
No, he didn't point to the wrong section. No, I'm sorry. There was a comma missing in that statement.
That was different. I am the king of the commas, apparently.
You said Representative Bruin pointed to the wrong...
Okay, you're on me. No. Representative Bruin correctly identified a mistake that had been made. He saved us from making a further mistake. Thank you, Representative Bruin, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for pointing that out. We are back here now.
Yes, absolutely.
Having hopefully streamlined the process in general and having heard testimony from a number of participants and balanced the concerns about safety of patients against the need and strong desire to provide health care, particularly in the rural areas of the state where we're having a difficult time recruiting.
Excuse me just for a moment. I do want to reassure people we'll open up the hearing on 3023 next. We have some anxious...
No,
I'm sorry, which one?
2589.
2589. We have some anxious moms and kids, and we want to make sure.
I'll try to be as brief as possible. During the work group, there was concern about the safety. The applicant must have a clean and current license from another state where they were previously participating. There will be a criminal record check performed during the review, and concern regarding the board's authority during the review or renewal of the process, we believe, has been addressed. At any point in the process, if the application is red flagged, even during the first 90 days, the board has the authority to yank the temporary license or not renew the temporary license. And the language throughout uses the word may and not shall, and hopefully thus retaining the board's authority. There's a question down here.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. In regards to the criminal history, that's one thing, but on page 2, line 2, who is not under investigation by the licensing board, a lot of times that information is not available to the public or even to the applicant or the licensee, I guess I should say. So I'm wondering you know, I don't know how we're going to know whether they could be under investigation by another state's licensing board. In our state, that initial investigation is covered by confidentiality, even from the licensee.
Taylor, would you join us?
Am I not correct?
I don't want to put words in the mouth of the board here. So.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Haley, the Executive Director for the Oregon Medical Board. To answer Representative Kenemer's question, we do have the ability to share state-to-state that confidential investigatory information.
And probably reciprocity as well, then?
Pardon me?
And other states have that same provision?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer, most of them do. I'm not sure that all of them do.
That's super. I just wasn't aware of that. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Are you feeling fairly comfortable with the bill as it's written?
Chair Greenlick, the board continues to have concerns about the bill relative to the board's core mission of public protection, and we have had some preliminary discussion with the parties about looking at an endorsement type of model that would apply to all applicants and would expedite the process across the state. So we're very excited and encouraged by that discussion, and we're happy to work with all the parties on that.
Hope we get a more permanent solution to, that would solve this problem.
Exactly.
Great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing then, we did extend the period of the temporary license, the duration of the temporary license from 60 to 90 days to deal with some concerns that surfaced. And the board is charged with reporting back to this body by 31st of January of 2011. That, in fact, the reporting requirement is what is to sunset in this bill, unless action is taken in the next legislative session. As Ms. Haley has just said, there is conversation with the OMA, the Oregon Medical Board, the hospitals, and the governor's office regarding a proposed amendment that would streamline the entire process, the entire licensing process. My hope is that this will be addressed on the Senate side, and that we would encourage that conversation to continue if we could pass this out of this body today.
Have we adopted that amendment yet?
No, Mr. Chair. This is a brand new amendment for the last meeting.
Okay. Do we have a motion on the amendment?
Wasn't certain that I could do that. Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the -5 amendments dated April 3rd to House Bill 2435.
Any discussion? We have a motion to adopt the -5 amendment, House Bill 2435. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I would further move that we send House Bill 2435 with a due pass recommendation to the floor with
as amended.
We have a motion on the floor to send 2435 as amended with the -5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support this motion with some reservation. I guess I wonder out loud, and perhaps I'll be persuaded by discussion, but I wonder why we would set a lower, I know others would construe it differently, but a different bar for physician qualification in certain parts of Oregon. If this is truly a system that will protect public safety, then let's make this the bar statewide. I guess I'd leave it at that. I really recognize and appreciate all the effort that's been made to try to strike this balance, and we know we have a problem getting physicians to rural areas and getting them to Oregon generally, but that's my concern.
My assumption is that the amendment for a new way of doing it would relate to the whole state, because I certainly agree with you on that.
Yes, that's my understanding as well, and there are additional heads, well-informed heads in the room nodding.
Mr. Chairman, not to create a litany here, but I just appreciate Representative Cannon's view, and I have reluctant support.
It may well be that the process that comes out of this was identified in response to a rural need, but that benefits the entire state.
Okay, ready? Call the roll, please.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll ask Representatives Roblin and Bence to co-carry this on the floor. Will you check in with them? Roxy, will you let them know? I would like to reopen a public hearing on House Bill 2583. I believe that's the number.
89.
I'm sorry, 2589. Thank you. My glasses are getting foggy. We have a large, will you introduce this? And then we have a large group of people. I'll ask you all to try and hold your testimony to about 3 minutes, and I'll use a timer to help. We absolutely have to be out by 5 today.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Emily McKnight to join me. I don't know if she's on your list, but
she's right on top of the list.
Here, I'll scoot over.
Okay, good second.
Representative Cannon, will we be okay if we don't have time to get to 3023 today?
Yes. Yeah. We can carry that over or reschedule it at your pleasure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46, and thanks for hearing this bill. I'll be brief and then let others who are better qualified than I to tell the stories behind it express why it's so important that we pass it. The genesis of this bill for me was a call from Ms. McKnight, one of my constituents, a couple of years ago. She asked me why the state that does not require insurers to cover hearing aids for her son, Parker. My staff and I did some investigation. It is, in fact, the case that that is not a required benefit, and Emily and Parker are here with me today to tell their story. But let me just make a few brief points about why I believe this should be on the list of required coverages. According to a 2008 study, 1,290 Oregon kids have unmet needs for hearing aids and hearing care. So over 1,200 kids, nearly 1,300 kids with unmet needs for hearing aids and hearing care. In 2007, as you heard, we mandated coverage of cochlear implants for kids with total hearing loss. That was, as Representative Maurer pointed out, applied only to insurers who already covered one ear. We have a newborn screening test, as you heard from Senator Walker, in place in order to get kids with hearing loss treated in order to promote cognitive and social development. And this bill, committee members, ensures that we fulfill the goal of our newborn screening program by ensuring that kids with diagnosed hearing loss, 82 kids diagnosed through that program in 2007, get the treatment that they need right away, not when their parents can scrape together the money to pay for this expensive product. So we passed that newborn screening test in a belief that it was important to diagnose this early and then treat it effectively, knowing the kinds of savings that would result from kids who are well-equipped to learn and to participate fully in their school and family lives. Now we have the opportunity to ensure that someone who is diagnosed at a young age, in fact, gets the treatment that they need. I will turn it over to Emily and Parker and let them share their stories with you.
Thank you very much.
First? Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Emily McKnight. I am here today to ask for your support for House Bill 2589, Parker's bill. I can only imagine, and I've seen, how many important bills are on the docket and how strongly supporters feel for each of these bills. But I believe this bill is long past due, and it has been passed in several other states. I must tell you that I have never aggressively pursued anything like this in my life. But I felt this must be done. I will briefly tell you my story in hopes you too will see the desperate need we have to pass this bill. My son Parker was born 10 weeks early and considered a miracle baby not only by our family but by a multitude of doctors. While we suffered through many medical issues in his first few years of life, we were thrilled that he was getting better and stronger every day. However, from very early in Parker's life, I knew that something was not right, but it was intangible. His pediatricians kept a close eye on Parker, but even after years of speech therapy, ear tubes, a tonsillectomy, and numerous requests for hearing tests, which seemed to come back inconclusive time after time, I struggled with the fact that my son was very different from other toddlers. In the grocery store, people would say, "What's your name?" And I would immediately interpret, "His name's Parker." His speech was virtually unintelligible to everyone but his immediate family. I thought he might have a hearing problem, but after the tests came back inconclusive, I didn't know where to turn, and Parker's hearing loss was still undiagnosed at the age of 4. How, I wonder, did I not determine the cause before age 4? Well, he was a good faker. When the truth about his hearing loss came to light, it was determined that Parker was already reading lips and body language. Yet the truth was a huge shock. At age 4, I finally insisted on a sound booth hearing test for Parker. Immediately after the test, we were told that Parker had severe hearing loss in both ears. The doctor said they were stunned that he was talking at all. In my immense grief at the news, there was also a sense of relief. There was finally an answer to what was wrong. We battled our pain and knowing that our son would never hear the world the way the rest of us did. He would never hear the music he so desperately loved to its fullest capacity, and knew that there would be labels he would carry throughout his life as the kid with hearing aids. If you have children, nieces, nephews, godchildren, neighbors, or any connection with a young child, you can only imagine, or you may have your own struggles, of the agony this caused us for our son. Yet when we fitted Parker with his loaner hearing aids, it took only a few weeks until our agony turned to a sense of joy. Parker was a different child. He changed so dramatically, we were almost in shock. His speech changed almost immediately. All those days of sounding like Roseanne Barr around my house were suddenly quieted. Truly, I did. My absolute panic at screaming after Parker as he rode ahead on his bike so that he wouldn't ride into the street with absolutely no response from Parker were eased with a boy who suddenly turned to my voice and stopped. It was as though a miracle had occurred. He seemed brilliant. He craved knowledge, and he was finally understood. Imagine my surprise when I went to order Parker's permanent hearing aids, and they told me that we would need $3,000 to $5,000 to pay for these aids, and they were not covered by insurance. I was stunned. My husband, a paramedic, had benefits, and I worked as well. How could hearing aids not be covered? Were these not considered vital for child development? I knew most companies... insurance companies covered glasses because if you can't see, you can't read or write or do most anything else. But if you can't hear, you can't read or write or do any of those other things as well. How could this be? As I began to research, I realized that insurance companies do cover cochlear implants, or my understanding was that they did, a $40,000 procedure. I continued to pursue this and could find no reason whatsoever why this would not be covered. I finally came to realize that insurance companies do not want to pay for hearing aids for the regular hearing loss that accompanies aging, so they cut them out for everybody. This is appalling. After seeing the difference in Parker, one could not possibly think that hearing aids are not a vital necessity for a child with hearing loss. I, however, am one of the lucky ones. We made the decision to get Parker hearing aids no matter what the cost was and what we would have to do to cut out of our family budget. Yet I have a larger perspective than just as a parent. I have been a high school teacher for 15 years and have been working predominantly with underprivileged kids and kids who have a variety of physical or emotional needs. One of these needs I saw over the years was students with hearing loss. I'm not a special education teacher, but teach kids that are deemed low level. The district I teach in pulls a very low income level of students. I found that many of these kids with hearing problems in my low level classes were not dumb, but simply missed out on hearing things at a young age and continued to do so. The families of these children either can't afford or won't prioritize hearing aids as a necessity, so these kids go without. Over time, they fall further and further behind until they can't catch up. The issue, however, that many don't see is that many of these kids end up relying on the government for subsidy in life because they are never able to get a job or function fully in society. This fact alone should be enough to warrant hearing aid coverage by insurance companies in light of the fact that the significant monies that could be saved in the long run. In addition, many of these children who do not get hearing aids early in life end up needing significant amounts of speech therapy and other services from the school district, which equates to money from the state education funds. On a personal note, again, I am shocked and horrified that insurance companies have been able to get away with not covering an essential need for children. Anyone who knew Parker in his pre-hearing aid days would assure you that he has truly blossomed and is a different child. We must give every child this chance. It is not even a question, but a must. Families should not have to choose between food on the table or hearing aids for their children. Please pass this bill for the sake of our children. It is hard enough to suffer the blow that your child has hearing loss, but then to be hit with the fact that you must pay for them because someone deemed they were not important enough to be covered. Thank you, members of the committee, and Chair Graylich, for your time.
Thank you very much.
Parker, did you want to say something quickly?
Remember when we were talking in the car? This is your turn to talk. Okay. You forgot about it. Remember, my name is Parker.
We'd be very happy if you'd say something to us.
That'd be great. Can you take your hand for just a second? Okay. You don't have to talk, okay? Stick your head up. So
got all dressed up to come down here.
He did. This is your one turn.
Go for it.
We'd sure like to hear. I'll tell you what, Parker. You go.
It's a tough call.
You want to sit down for a minute?
You go Parker, back and sit for a minute. When you feel comfortable enough, you come on back.
He asked how old you were.
Parker, how old are you?
6 3/4.
You're 6 3/4. What day is your birthday?
June 27th.
June, it's coming up. That's outstanding. Yeah.
June 27th.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. June 27th.
That's great. Yeah.
Do you want to say anything else? No.
Okay. I have a question.
Sure, but obviously we're.
Did you see the gold man on top of the building? If you haven't seen it, make sure your mom shows it to you on your way out.
The gold man on the building.
Way up on top.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, you're showing your generation. It's the gold dude, Parker.
Easy now.
My grandkids are very tolerant of me. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Can we have Christy Knight, Marilyn Hartzell, and Jerry Donnelly, please? And please try and hold your comments to 3 minutes if you can. Please introduce yourself as you begin.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Christy Knight, and I'm a pediatric audiologist at the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center at Oregon Health and Science University. As a pediatric audiologist, I diagnose hearing loss in infants and children and recommend treatment and intervention when permanent hearing loss is identified. The most important intervention for children with mild to severe hearing loss is hearing aid amplification. Hearing loss is a medical condition, and hearing aids are a necessary treatment. Insurance coverage for hearing aids is a cost-effective way of providing infants and children easy and immediate access to hearing technology, and I fully support House Bill 2589. Without assistance from insurers, families are left to confront the financial expenses of hearing loss on their own. For many families, then, they're required to make a difficult choice between obtaining hearing aids that are affordable versus those that are most effective. Due to cost concerns, children's hearing aids may not be repaired or replaced as often as needed, and this adversely affects a child's development. As an example, I'd like to tell you about a family I've been working with for the past year and a half whose son was diagnosed with a brain tumor at 18 months. He required aggressive chemotherapy, and one of the agents needed to treat his cancer caused permanent hearing loss in both ears. The family has excellent insurance but no hearing aid benefits. Their financial resources were exhausted due to their son's medical treatment. He's used loaner hearing aids for over a year while they have saved money every month to purchase hearing aids for him. Recently purchased hearing aids for him, and he's doing beautifully. I have to tell you that the loaner hearing aids that we needed to use for him were not optimal. They were older technology. They were the best that we could offer them at that point. But families shouldn't have to make this kind of choice. I'd like to provide just some brief information about the provisions of House Bill 2589, and these were recommended by families of hearing-impaired children as well as pediatric audiologists around the state. The bill would provide benefits for hearing aids for children under the age of 18. This is critical because in children, untreated hearing loss significantly affects their speech and language acquisition and development, educational achievement, educational achievement, social and emotional development, quality of life, and future economic opportunities. The bill would provide one hearing aid per hearing impaired ear as necessary for the treatment of hearing loss. The maximum benefit amount is $4,000 every 48 months. That was based on the public employees benefit that's provided to both state employees who are adults and children. It would provide children access to quality technology. Young children that are in the process of growing and hearing speech and language for the first time really need features that allow them to hear better in noise, allow for more flexibility in programming the device, mechanisms for controlling hearing aid feedback, which is whistling, without having to reduce the high frequency information, which is critical for speech perception. So these things are important. Sorry, and I'll summarize quickly. Just by saying that this bill would affect a small number of children in Oregon, but would have a tremendous impact on their development and quality of life. All infants and children with hearing loss need easy and immediate access to hearing aid amplification, and this bill would make that possible. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do I need to pull this slightly toward me? excuse me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you and speak on this House bill. I'm Marilyn Hartzell, and I have the privilege to serve as director of the Oregon Center for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs, otherwise fondly known as OCEAN. OCEAN is the state's public health program for children with special health needs, administered through, located at, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center at OHSU. Our collective mission is to improve the lives of individuals with disabilities or special health needs, and this mission is exemplified through our commitment to excellence in interdisciplinary clinical practices, research, education, policy development, and community service. I'm here today to share our statewide perspective on the needs of these families and their children with chronic or disabling conditions, and to give emphasis to the potential benefit that passage of House Bill 2589 could have on children and families of our state. Much of what I have to say has already been said, and given the late hour of the day, I won't restate those items. They are in my written testimony. I would reemphasize that although we mandate screening in our state, we do not allow for the proper intervention to be available to all families with children who are diagnosed with a hearing loss. We know that the ability to hear is critical to its development, we've heard that repeatedly, and social-emotional development. We've also been reminded of the benefits provided for cochlear implants. But those are only appropriate to children whose loss cannot benefit from hearing aids. In Oregon, there is precedence, you've heard it repeatedly, the benefits of our Oregon Health Plan and the public employees benefit, but not for families with private insurance. There is no hearing benefit whatsoever. Currently, this amounts to about what we consider 60% of our children with special health care needs in Oregon. There are 12 states that have corrected this, and I would ask you to reconsider allowing Oregon to become the 13th state. Thank you for your time. Good day.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Mr.
Dennehy.
Mr. Dennehy, and now I see that's an H.
Yeah. I messed up a little bit when I did it. Thank you, Chairman and the committee, for holding this hearing. I'm here to support House Bill 2589. My wife, Lydia, and myself, we grew up here in Oregon after coming from other places. My wife, mostly on the south coast of Oregon, and I grew up in the Grants Pass and Gold Hill area and graduated from Hidden Valley High School. My wife and I met in 2000 in Portland and married in 2002. My wife is hearing impaired and largely due to ear infections as a child. When my son Aiden was born in 2005, we were very ecstatic and happy that he had passed his hearing test. And we were very careful about making sure that he had no ear infections going forward. About a year ago, I was noticing that my son Aiden was holding his ear to the speaker and holding his ear to toys and kind of off in his own world. And I thought, well, it might be just a kid being a kid. He passed his hearing test when he was an infant. So I told my wife, please take him in and go up to OHSU and get him checked out. And I was so unconcerned at the time that when I came home that night, I asked my wife, his hearing's fine, right? And she goes, we'll talk later. And discovered that he had hearing loss and needed hearing aids. Got into some great programs with the Columbia Regional Program, and we got loaner hearing aids within a few months. Thankfully, my son has no developmental delays of any type. In October, suddenly the talk turned to purchasing hearing aids. And due to the great support we got before that, I thought they'd be covered by the same program, and it wasn't. I went through many of the different programs and foundations that cover hearing aids for children. We're just above the income limits in the middle class, where too rich to get some of the benefits and a little too poor to pay for it all on our own. So I wrote all the representatives and urged passage of this bill. Additionally, I went to my own insurance company and asked them for coverage, and they said yes, and they got coverage for both my wife and my son Aiden. And suddenly my incentive to get something passed was a little bit lessened, because I'd taken care of myself, but I wanted to make sure and continue on. The risk for myself personally is that if this bill passes, I could get more coverage for my son, but I could lose coverage for my wife. But I thought that risk was better for the children of Oregon, to make sure that everyone got cover that needed it. I understand the concern about insurance mandates, and I agree with a lot of that talk, but I think this is an important targeted bill, targeted at children only, and I'd appreciate passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to...
Mr. Chair, one quick question. Mr. Dennehy?
Yes.
You have a friend, don't you?
Yeah.
Kathy Mahama?
Kathy Mahama. Yep. We actually went to prom together.
She's a really good friend of mine.
Yeah. Thank you
very much. We're going to try and get the rest of the folks on and get a couple of folks who are here from Lane County on the next bill. We won't have to come back. So would you recognize some written testimony we have, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have a letter from Elsa Nelson from the Hearing Speech Institute. We have a letter from...
Excuse me just a moment. Can I ask John McCulley, Jennifer Castellegno, and Catherine Bradley to join us? And please go ahead.
We have a letter from Kristen Knight. We have some materials, support House Bill 2589, Parker's Bill, and some information on children's hearing aid coverage in Oregon. We have a letter from Parker McKnight and Emily McKnight dated April 10th, 2009. We have remarks by Dr. Marilyn Hartzell dated April 10th. We have a letter from Bridget Wellburn. We have a letter from Sandra R. Thompson dated April 10th. We have a letter signed by Glenda Smith Fowler and Nadine Palmeter. And we have a letter from Kristen Lilly. And we have a letter from Marcia A. Zager dated April 10th.
And the record will remain open while we're still working. So if other people want to submit written testimony, that would be great. Please.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Castellano. This is my son, Ben. He's enjoying himself today. I have a little letter I'd like to read you to give you a little background about Ben and myself. Finding out your baby is deaf is like being hit with a pile of bricks, invisible bricks. He's warm and soft and snuggled in my arms, and he looked perfect. How could something be wrong? But at 12 hours old, I was told he failed his hearing test. Impossible. The nurses must have botched the test. But still, through the denial, I felt pain coming from somewhere. At 2 weeks old, we took our baby to get another hearing test. He failed. The dull, throbbing pain of those invisible bricks returned. I could have sworn he flinched when we banged the pots and pans over his head, desperately trying to perform our own hearing tests. After a visit to an ENT, a different audiologist, and two more hearing tests, we had our answer. Our son is deaf. All the I love you whispers and lullaby tunes had truly gone unheard. He'll really never know my voice. The bricks pushed so hard I couldn't breathe. That long, deep exhale of relaxed contentment of a world full of bright futures and sunny skies that exists in the world of our son were crushed by the dark news of which I had just heard. I'm his mother. My job is to fix what goes wrong in his world. I hung on the glimmer of hope provided by the audiologist. He may be able to hear some sounds with a hearing aid. Hearing aids would be the answer. I knew it. I researched and found that with my son's severe loss, he would need high-powered hearing aids, expensive hearing aids. Our insurance doesn't cover hearing aids. We couldn't deny our child a chance to hear. Sacrifices could be made. We have a car we no longer drive. Someone might buy it. My husband could work longer hours. I could cut my maternity leave short. Those bricks grew heavier. We were lucky, blessed. The Willamette ESD loaned us hearing aids to see if our son responded to sound. On April 1st, at 9 weeks old, my son tried on his first pair of hearing aids. As we snapped the battery door shut, we held our breath. I didn't know what to say. Then, it's Mommy. He opened his eyes, and he looked at my face. He heard my voice. My son wears his hearing aids whenever he's awake. He smiles more. He enjoys patty cake and Twinkle Twinkle. We listen to Mozart. I can soothe him with my voice when he cries and he hears my goodnight whispers. If we were not able to borrow hearing aids, my child would be missing these sounds. Soon we will need to buy Ben his own pair of hearing aids. Unfortunately, the high cost of hearing aids creates a barrier for families like ours. Our insurance does not cover any of the expenses associated with hearing aids. Sacrifices will need to be made. It is not fair that Ben should have to get less expensive, less effective hearing aids, or our family have financial constraints. We pay for health insurance to cover our family's medical needs. My child's eyesight is covered. Why not his hearing? Should he be denied the opportunity to attend regular education classes, develop normal speech, and listen to Mozart? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And tell Ben thanks for coming, too. Ben's a pretty good name, incidentally. We know that.
Oh, he's very thrilled to be here.
John, Kathleen?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm here today representing the Oregon Speech, Language, and Hearing Association. We're the professional association of speech and language pathologists and audiologists, and we just wanted to add our voices in support of House Bill 2589. You've heard from professionals already about the value of hearing aids in children who are hearing impaired. Our speech language pathologists work with those children in schools, or audiologists are involved in diagnosing and fitting for hearing aids, and we think this bill is a good step forward, and we encourage your adoption.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bradley, I have a little trouble with Kathleen Brady in one bill and Catherine Bradley in the next, keeping the name straight. So I think I now have it for you.
Chair Greenlick, thank you very much. As long as it's not Kathy.
No.
Chair Greenlick and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today speaking for our Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Program that is located within the Public Health Division, as well as for the DMAP program, the Medicaid program for the division or for the department. And we just wanted to go on record for the fact that we do support this bill. We think that the options that should be available to all of Oregon's children should be comparable to the options that are available under the Oregon Health Plan. We also wanted to draw your attention just in the testimony which you have before you that you can look in. Most of this information has already been identified by other speakers, but we do know that that in a survey of about 96 families of hearing-impaired children, 99% of the families had health insurance, and yet only 43% of the families received any assistance at all with hearing aid costs. So we do feel that this is a very significant issue that needs to be addressed by the Oregon community and are very supportive of that. we're available to you or for any other questions you might have. Thank you.
Is that formal DHS support of this bill?
Yes, that is, Chair Greenlake.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I'm going to close this public hearing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, one quick clarification. Oregon
open
Medicaid
this public hearing.
Does cover hearing aids.
Chair Greenlake and Representative Thompson, currently hearing aids are covered under the Oregon Health Plan for Children. Yes.
Are they? I'm sorry. Currently, they are lines 380 and line 463, if I'm not mistaken. But there's only a $600 benefit every 3 years.
Yeah.
That's in one of the.
Representative Greenlake and Chair Maurer, I'm actually not sure of the amount, and I can verify that and have that information provided to the committee.
I wish you would. That would be great. I would like to close this public hearing. There are some folks from out of town I'd like to have a chance to hear, and we will get back to it. It would be great if you would send us that information. Also wouldn't mind hearing from some people in the insurance industry on this, some along the line. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3023, and invite first of all the folks from out of town to join us. We have four people on the list: Andrew Plambeck, Sarah Cassidy, Jason Barudi, and Michaela Gore. Why don't we get you all up, and if we can all, any of you that are left, and if we can hold you to 3 minutes.
Michaela is left, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we have three.
And as they're coming up, let me just say to members, the few continuing members from last session's Health Care Committee may remember discussing this concept in last session, and may, in fact, remember Ms. Cassidy, who helped bring this issue to our attention and draft the bill. We've refined it. We have amendments. I don't think we'll be able to look at those in any detail today, but I hope we're able to return to it.
I'm sorry. Yes, we will return to it, and I was happy to hear you have some amendments that move us closer to
I think closer
to the goal line.
Yep.
Excellent. Please. Whoever.
Chair Greenlake, Committee, Representative Cannon. My name is Sarah Cassidy. I am a resident of Salem, Oregon, out in Polk County, and am currently a third-year law student at Willamette University College of Law. Thank you for your time today and hearing me. Briefly, in 2007, a classmate of mine, Aaron Cecil Levine, and I were enrolled in a lawmaking process course at Willamette, and had the opportunity to work on a legislative proposal to improve the access to health care for young adults such as ourselves. Both Aaron and I had experienced difficulty with obtaining or maintaining health insurance during our 20s. Aaron had dealt with a period of being uninsured, where she had amassed substantial medical bills. I myself had transitioned between part-time jobs. Both part-time jobs did provide health insurance, but maintaining coverage during the interim, where I amassed the hours to have the new job insurance kick in. It was difficult on the budget, even though I did elect to do COBRA. Limitations of COBRA made it difficult. So we looked at the problem in Oregon and found that we weren't alone. In 2006, 15.6% of all Oregonians were uninsured, but the rates for young 20-somethings, all 20-somethings, were more drastic. For ages 21 to 24, 41.6% were uninsured. For age is 25 to 29, 31.8% of all Oregonians were uninsured. The reason for this is that many health insurance policies and benefit plans terminate coverage at age 19 or when a child is no longer a full-time student enrolled in an accredited public secondary institution. And often at this time in their lives, they're engaged in low wage, such as myself, or temporary employment that don't provide health benefits. So it becomes difficult to secure stable, affordable sources of health insurance. So Aaron and I took a look at what other states had done, and we brought a proposal based on what we saw to Representative Cannon. And the essence of that proposal is what is in House Bill 3023. Just in front of you in my written testimony, there is a non-exhausted survey of what some other states have done. In particular, I'd like to draw your attention to the New Jersey law on which House Bill 3023 is modeled. New Jersey maintains a dependent can be covered up to age 30 as long as they have no dependents of their own. The insurance provider can charge a higher rate for that extra coverage, there are limits on how much can be charged. In 2009, the age-out limit under New Jersey's plan was raised from age 30 to age 31. And in that interim, 15,000 young adults in New Jersey obtained coverage, 5,000 of those obtaining insurance for a short time, 10,000 still remaining enrolled. Based on the numbers, that's about 10% of those that were uninsured that then took advantage of the law. Based on New Jersey's proposal, New York has also made a proposal, 31%. They're also estimating that 10% of New Yorkers would take advantage of the law. In New York, that's 800,000 people, 80,000 people. Looking at the numbers in Oregon, just to conclude briefly, the population in 2006 of this age group, and doing some math with how much were uninsured, this law could affect 20,000 Oregonians.
Thank you very much. And thanks for being persistent. You found out you don't get things the first session, right?
We've all learned that.
Sometimes not the second or third session either, but we keep trying.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jason Beirutti. I am an employee benefits consultant here in Salem and a member of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. I wanted to speak today briefly in support of this bill. Our Health Underwriters Association likes finding ways to make commercial insurance plans available and affordable, and we think there's some components of this that do that. I think we had some of the same statistics, so I'm going to jump around a little bit here with what I was talking about. Practically, the things that we run into when people turn 23, oftentimes the parents are not anticipating what's going to happen. So the kid loses coverage on the group plan. It's too late. There's not enough time for them to get an individual plan. So people end up sort of falling through the cracks and related that they just don't get coverage. There is COBRA and continuation available when that happens. However, the COBRA and continuation tends to be more expensive to put a kid as on an individual rate versus just keeping them as a dependent in that capacity. The other thing is when somebody goes on COBRA or continuation, it's not deductible. The convenience of it and the fact of it is just much easier for people to leave the kid on their employer-sponsored plan. It gets payroll deducted for them. It just tends to get done easier. I was telling a story earlier today about a physician friend of mine whose fourth son came up on this. He turned 23. He calls me after a couple months and says, "Hey, I haven't got around to getting my son coverage." I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He goes, "Well, we just haven't done anything yet." I said, "Well, Mel, that doesn't make much sense because we could have got an individual policy. We could have done these other things." He said, "Well, it was an inconvenience for him to go through that process." So we helped him through that process, but this would get away from that. It would just get more people covered. I think the other important thing is younger people tend to be healthier, and so the more people that we can continue to keep in the pool, insured in the commercial market, I think benefits the market as a whole. So that's concluding my remarks.
Thank you very much.
My name is Andrew Planbeck. I'm the student at the University of Oregon and the chief of staff of the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. I'd like to thank Chair Greenlick and the members of the committee for allowing me to come here today. I am one of those 20,000 that this bill would affect. As currently stands, I will be graduating in June from the university, and I will be, at that point, no longer eligible for benefits on my parents' Kaiser plan. And so, at this point, like so many of my peers, I am entering the toughest job market in generations, and I do not have a job lined up. So, at this time, I have very few prospects for an opportunity to maintain health coverage. And I think that this is something that, you know, makes that scary real world just that much scarier, is that I don't have an option for that, and I don't have the financial means to buy into an independent plan of any substance, and I absolutely will need benefits. I'm healthy, and I do have, you know, good eating habits and exercise habits and all of that, but anything can happen. And so I think that this bill is an excellent, excellent piece of legislation, and I think that it would do great to really help my peers and I just have a little bit of leeway as we come out of college and are looking for jobs in an incredibly competitive market that now I have students in my classes that are fighting each other for unpaid internships from which they will not receive benefits because so many employers of public and private industry are just not hiring. And I just thank you for the time to listen to me here today, and I would urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? I'll add a story from my private experience, which to point out this isn't only an insurance company problem. My grandson was covered on his parents, on his parents' double coverage, Kaiser coverage. They're Portland Public School employees. And he made the mistake of graduating a year early to save them $45,000 and took an AmeriCorps gig on his way to graduate school. Well, he was informed months after by Kaiser that he had been cut off their coverage, even though he was only 21. And when his parents inquired of Kaiser, they said, "No, it's not our problem. We'll be happy to keep him. It's the employer that refuses to have him covered, even though there's no effect on the cost at all." So it turned out it was the Health and Welfare Trust of the Portland Public School employees thing that demanded he be taken off health insurance, even though his health insurance company was willing to keep him on. So this is this can be a weird and arcane problem, but one that I think we do need to solve. I think your plight, you may not be the only college student worrying about.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm the only college graduate. I guess the answer is to go to law school, right?
That's right. That's what everyone says, is stay in school as long as possible.
Chair Green, if I could add one more thing to that. Before I testified, I came over today, I called two carriers. I realized as an employee benefits consultant, I should know what the small group market is, specifically with the dependent age. We got an argument in our office whether it was age 23 or age 25. So we called two carriers, and one of them told us that it was 23, and one of them told us it was 25. So there is some confusion in the marketplace, too, related to
that. Well, I suppose they can do whatever they want, too.
And, Mr. Chair, in that situation, it wouldn't work because that's a self-funded plan under ERISA and doesn't apply to 3023.
Right. You mean in my case or that one?
In yours.
No, I was just pointing out, though, that it isn't only a problem with the insurance company. It's sometimes a problem with the employers.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Harker.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to point out that another solution is to move to Canada, like my daughter did, who's 23 now, and she's in town this weekend and was in the building here this morning. Comparing costs, she claimed that they didn't really have free health care up there. It cost her $50 a month to have health care in Canada.
Well, it won't solve your job problem. But
I was going to say, I would prefer to stay at home in Oregon, now, and that's why I come to you today.
He would prefer his daughter did, too.
Yeah, the people in that age bracket are young and healthy. They're also those adrenaline junkies that you talked about. I lived through that period, of course. I remember it really well. It was great fun.
Okay, we will schedule work sessions on all the bills we heard today. That doesn't mean we'll necessarily work them, but we'll keep them alive and make decisions. Today was mandate day. I noticed people in the insurance industry kind of keeping an eye on us. We'll be talking seriously about what mandates mean.
Which is just a couple days before tax day.
Mr. Chair.
Who are we talking about?
Yeah. Do we have any other testimony on this?
No, that's it. Why, do you want to testify?
Just curious what the industry thinks.
I asked the industry if they wanted to testify on this one or the last one or any other one. Not the industry, but I asked a couple of industry folks. Their answer was no. But I suspect when we get serious, we'll hear about it. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3023. Thank all the witnesses for being brief. And we'll adjourn not only for the day, but for the week.